Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 331. Gobble, gobble. Happy Thanksgiving. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in thisshowissogay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a cornucopia we have for you this week. We bring to you our guest, Justin Martindale. Justin is a comedian, an actor, a writer, and so much more. He's been seen as a guest on E's Live From E, as well as the series Worst Thing I Ever. In 2014, he was the co-creator for the hit Funny or Die web series Not Looking, which I enjoyed immensely. It received acclaim from Slate Magazine, The Advocate, Huffington Post, and a ton of other media. He's written for Joan Rivers on Fashion Police. He's opened for Sandra Bernhard, Whitney Cummings, and our great friend Fortune Feimster. He's performed on cruises, and he's been on Logo TV's One Night Stand-Up. He's also been heard on such podcasts as The Joe Rogan Experience, Skeptic Tank, and now you can hear him on the podcast This Show Is So Gay right this very second. Justin, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, thanks for having me. Wow, you really got them all, didn't you?
I feel like I left some out, Justin, because we would not have any time to chat.
I think that's pretty much all of them. Just stuff all those credits in a cornucopia for Thanksgiving.
There you go. We have to start with that. Justin, what are you thankful for this Thanksgiving?
What am I thankful for? You know, I think I'm just thankful that I get the chance to eat with my friends and drink and pass out and fart.
All right.
That's pretty much it.
Okay.
You know, I'm thankful. I've had a really good year, and I've had a really fun journey the past 6 years that I've been doing stand-up, and, you know, this is actually my 10th year living in Los Angeles, so I kind of have this one of those moments to just kind of reflect and kind of take it all in, and I really do. I'm very thankful
awesome.
This year for everything that I've kind of accomplished and working on and whatnot, so I'm happy for that.
Awesome, awesome. Well, we have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Oh, let's do it.
Okay, we start with you as we start with all the comics who have been on our show before you. Where does Justin Martindale find the funny?
Where do I find the funny? I mean, in every day. I find the funny in just things that I see, things that I hear, just stupid things that people say.
Yeah.
Politicians included. Yeah, I just find the funny in everyday kind of things, you know, just hot topics that people are talking about and how people make such a big deal out of little things and, you know, how people are so passionate about just stupid, mundane kind of things, you know, things that we all make fun of. But, you know, I like to get on stage and talk about it.
I love it. Now, originally from Texas?
Uh-huh.
If I went back to San Antonio, which I assume that I will do for next week's episode to interview your family that's still there, what would they say about little Justin Martindale? Was he a funny kid?
Oh, yeah. I was a blast. I was definitely the scene stealer. My dad always loved to, like, he was one of those dads who recorded everything, like, everything. He was the dad with the camcorder attached to his head.
Nice.
And so it's so funny because I really actually want to find some of those old videos because I just want to, like, look at them and post them because I was seriously that kid. He's like, look at me, over here. And they're like, God damn it, Justin, get out of the way. I'm like, wait, what? I'm over here. They're like, we see you. Get out of here. You know? So, yeah, I was always just a handful. I was always, you know, wanting to be in the spotlight and always wanting attention and always wanted top billing.
So what I hear you saying then is that this career choice may not have been the biggest shocker to your family?
No, they always kind of knew that I was going to be some sort of, like, actor or, like, some sort of entertainer. That's what they always kind of pushed me for. I actually had a lot of people tell me, like, oh, you should do stand-up, you should be a comedian. Like, this is when I was a kid in school. And I was like, I was afraid of it.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of, like, fell into place. And I've always enjoyed making people laugh.
So was there that one pivotal moment where you thought, okay, I'm going to just make a go of this?
Yeah, actually it was. I was, let's see, it was 2008 in Los Angeles, and I was still kind of like, do I want, like, I was still stuck in this, like, how does this entertainment industry work? Like, do I, like, everyone was like, oh, you just get an agent. I'm like, okay, well, how does that happen?
Right.
Like, where do I throw my name in a bucket and, like, someone picks it or what? And so the recession had hit here in Los Angeles, and it was really, really bad. I'm sure it's bad all over, but, like, here, especially because, you know, you have so many actors and stuff who rely on, you know, restaurants and stuff to kind of, like, make their income and, you know, wait tables and whatnot at the time. And so, like, a lot of restaurants and stuff were closing, and a lot of, like, Hollywood clubs were opening, and they would close, like, 2 weeks later because they couldn't pay their staff. So there was a period of time where I was, like, busting my balls, like, just trying to hold a job for, like, you know, a week, 2 weeks, you know, just trying to figure it out. And I was like, what am I doing? So I was watching this special on Logo, and I was like, I'm way funnier than this guy. And so I honestly just, like, reached out, and I was like, what do I have to lose? You know, I was like, I reached out to my buddy Bruce Daniels, who had a night at the time. It was kind of like a, it wasn't an open mic, but it was kind of like a, you know, if you want to be stand-up, we'll give you a shot in this room. Him and Aaron Foley had a roommate called Drunk on Stage. And I was like, hey, I just want to try it out. He's like, you've got 6 minutes. And I was terrified. I was like, 6 minutes? That's an eternity. And so when I did it, finally, it was the first time that I actually, it made sense. Like, I was like, this feels right. Something had clicked in my head that I was like, oh, I like this. Like, I'm making people laugh. And so from then, like from October to about June of 2009, October 2008 to June 2009, I started doing these, you know, monthly shows. I never did an open mic. I was like, I kind of like missed that phase, which I'm kind of thankful for.
Yeah.
Just, so finally, like around June 2008, I got this like shot performing at the Comedy Store on Sunset. And I remember the Comedy Store. The Comedy Store, if you don't know, is like this huge, it's kind of where stand-up comedy started, like Arsenio Hall, Roseanne,
right.
Harry, Robin Williams, all these, David Letterman, Jay Leno, all got their start there. And so I remember going down Sunset and being like, God, I want my name on that wall one day. So I had the chance to perform at the Springer show, like one night, it was the night after Michael Jackson died. There was about 18 of us performing, and it was crowded. It was a weird, crazy, witchy vibe in the air.
Okay.
And I got up on stage and got off stage and got whisked away into the ticket booth at the front. And the man who was running that was like, you just got passed by Mitzi Shore. And I was like, I have no idea what that means. But what? And he was like, you are the last one that she passed. She just came down from her castle, popped in, and saw you perform and said, he has it, and that's it. The rest
is history.
So I was like, well, I don't even know. What does that even mean? It's like, you're a paid regular now. So technically, I have the title of being the last person that she kind of pointed. She discovered all those guys I just mentioned. So I'm the last one in the book of the found ones, you know.
You got
so
knighted.
It's kind of a cool honor, and it's kind of cool that, you know, and I'm gay. she found me. It all kind of fell into place at that moment. So that was, you know, 6 years ago. And, yeah, and I've just been moving forward and just trying to be better and better.
Now, I do not want any names here, Justin. Do not say any names. But have you ever met the person who was performing on Logo who you thought you were funnier than?
Yes.
That's the end of that story. That's all we're saying about that. Okay, we'll leave it there.
Guy, actually. I love it.
What do you remember about those 6 minutes? What was the material for those first 6 minutes?
I remember. I think I talked about growing up in Texas. I talked about, you know, my stepfather was Hispanic, and I talked about, like, being a little white kid raised by Mexicans, and I felt like Mowgli from the Jungle Book, Tarantula Lash, you know, soap operas, telenovelas. I think I talked about how people tell you you look like famous people, and all the famous people that I look like are, like, dead Universal Studios monsters. Like, a little girl say I look like Frankenstein, and someone said I look like Lurch. I don't know, something along those lines.
I love it.
It was a good 6 minutes.
Now, I have seen clips of you doing stand-up. You, in one of them, you contend that gay kids today have it easier. Do you still stand by that?
I don't necessarily. It wasn't like a. I do feel like gay kids have it a lot easier. They do today, yes, for sure. And I mean that in the sense of like coming out.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like it's very more appreciated. It's a lot more celebrated. You know, you get all these kids now who you know, they're like, well, I'm going to put on my YouTube channel and come out.
Right.
You know, and everyone's like, hooray, you did it. We have your back. Yay, finally. You know, they like throw a party, you know. And I don't want to be like that guy's like, when I was a kid. and they still have it hard, too. I mean, I couldn't even imagine being a kid in school now with smartphones. And,
right.
You know, every Twitter and everything like at your fingertips. I mean, I'm sure there is, I know for a fact, there's still horrible cases of like bullying and, you know, and teasing and whatnot. But I just feel like in the sense of coming out personally, I think it's a lot easier for kids now because I feel the majority of people are more accepting and loving, you know, when I did it, I lucked out because, you know, I had a loving family and everything. But again, I was in Texas when I came out, which was very, you know, Republican and very, you know, Bible Belt. But there was a time where I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this because I'm afraid I'm going to, like, lose all my friends.
Right.
You know. But I do feel like it's a lot easier for kids to come out now.
I love that you give a shout out to the kid whose name I don't know either, who you just can find in the background of any number of shows just posing. It's very impressive.
I think his name's Brandon.
Okay, could be.
The kid from the viral video?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I forget his name. I think it's Brandon. I'm not sure, but yeah. I mean, I was that kid.
Right.
When I was a kid, I was that kid, and that's what I was trying to say in that joke is like, you know, when I do that joke on stage, I'm the kid that I'm talking about, you know? It's the kid that I always wanted to be, but I couldn't. So it's kind of nice being able to finally get that out of my system on stage in front of a vast audience where I'm just kind of like, all right, I'm going to just work it out how I always wanted to when I was a little kid, you know?
Oh, it's okay.
I mean, that kid in those videos is my hero. I'm like, oh, it is the funniest thing ever. I love it. And now he's like doing runway shows and he's been on like the Queen Latifah show and he's just living.
He is living.
Yeah.
Now, you've performed with so many other out comics. I love that you've done these shows, all these different shows, and we've had so many of your buddies on our show, Aaron Foley and Dana Goldberg and Jason Stewart, and these shows that feature out comics. What does it mean to you to do shows that feature out comics, not only yourself, but other people on that bill?
I mean, I love it. I think it's great, and I love that I just love everybody's courage because I feel like all those people, I personally don't like, I mean, it's not like I don't like it, but I don't like the term gay comic. I like the term comic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I know like Dana Goldberg, Aaron Foley, and all those guys, they can hold their own in a room full of people. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's not necessarily, it has to be a gay show or like, come to Sparkle Tuesdays or whatever, you know? I just love it that we can all kind of hold our own in front of any sort of an audience.
Yeah.
And I do feel that, I mean, it's time, you know, it's like, I just love that we're all working hard to just kind of bust out into that mainstream. And I feel like some of us have done that. And I feel that some of us are doing it even more so. I personally just love it when, you know, I'm getting these chances to go on the road and perform with, you know, different comics and whatever, that people are like, are you gay? And I'm like, what? Did you not see anything? Because I don't necessarily mention my sexuality on stage. That's not like, you know, I get beef because I don't, and I get, you know, people are like, why don't you talk about it on stage? I'm like, because there's just so much more to talk about.
Right.
I need to get up there and talk about, like, oh, so, who's the bottom? Am I right? You know, it's like, there's just so much more to talk about. I mean, I feel like all those people that you did mention, I mean, I think they're all great. And I think it's definitely fun to be on a bill with those people because they're doing it right, for
yeah.
sure. And
yeah.
I admire them.
Again, listeners, we are here with comic Justin Martindale. Justin, you've done one of those things that just, it is my nightmare. So you have performed on a cruise. I have to tell you, there's nothing that I could think of more that would be my nightmare. But I hear good things about it.
Oh, yeah. That was a long 11 days. It was a great cruise. went to the Mediterranean, went to Egypt, but every night it was just a different party, you see the same people every day. But my favorite thing about that cruise was I had a show that night, and I had to actually compete against Patti LuPone.
Oh, God.
With, what you do. Patti LuPone was in the next theater next door. So I had a good show of about a tight audience of about 5 people.
Oh, good. But a quality five.
They were there for substance. They were there for real theater. And, oh, my God, I got so drunk that day. we were in Santorini, Greece, and I was with Sean Pulaski and Daniel Leary, and Sean Pulaski introduced me to Uzo. But yeah. And I was like, this tastes like jelly beans, and I just drank like a gallon of it, and I had to perform in front of 5 people, and it was the worst show ever, but it was just so fun because I got to experience, the worst show ever. And I had my buddies Emerson Collins with me, and his boyfriend at the time, and it was just such a fun time. But yeah, it can be a little intimidating. Tons of nut huggers, Speedos. I actually got introduced to that, that bathing suit that was kind of like trending for a little bit, where it's just like the little pouch in the front and then it just wraps around the one leg.
I have seen that, yes.
That was actually, that was 2009? Yeah, that was 2009, so that's been around for a while. But that's when I experienced that. But yeah, cruises are fun. They can be very intimidating, but it was a good time.
All right.
I'd love to go back again. I don't know. I would love to do that for sure.
Let's leave a little bit of room for maybe there were more than 5 people. You just had so much Uzo that you're not sure.
Right. Maybe it was just one person.
Yes. And I just saw 5 people. He just kept moving seats. You're not sure. You have no idea.
Patti LuPone, yeah.
It was Patti LuPone. Yeah. She wasn't even in the theater.
Absolutely.
Oh, she's still talking about that duet that you two did that night. I wish you remembered it.
I really wish I did, too.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Now, let's talk about Not Looking, which I enjoyed immensely. That had to have been a fulfilling project for you.
Oh, we had so much fun doing that. That was actually the hardest project I've ever worked on, but it was just such a fulfilling experience. Yeah, we did the first season just kind of like on a whim. Me and my buddy Jason Looney, who plays Parker in the series with me, we were at the Comedy Store. And they did this weird thing with the actual show Looking, where they were trying to cast. They were actually just trying to cast it. And they were having such a hard time casting it in L.A. And they brought in everybody. Like, everybody tested for that show. I know for a fact that I read for Jonathan Groff's character for like 5 times. Like, they had me come in 5 separate times. They had me actually read for Dom, the mustache daddy guy.
Yeah.
They had me read for that, and then they had me read for the Jonathan Groff character. But like, all of us went in there. I know Bobby Lee went in for one of them. He was just like, why am I even here? I'm like, I was thinking the same thing. But so Jason and I were at the Comedy Store one night, and then they had the billboard for Looking, and we were like, that could have been us. So Jason and I decided that we were going to do like a parody. I was like, you know what's really funny is when Funny or Die does like parodies on like actual shows.
Yeah.
So the Looking trailer actually started airing, and I was like, why don't we do a parody of the actual Looking trailer, because it was like, oh, being in your 30s is hard. What are we going to do with our lives? So we tried to do an L.A. version of that. Like, how would it be in L.A.? So we did it as a joke and posted up on Funny or Die, and that's when it just kind of went viral.
It was crazy.
Like, every magazine, everyone was like, this is Looking we wanted to see, and Funny or Die approached us and was like, hey, do you want to do a kind of like a little series about it? And we were like, all right, cool, let's do it. So the first season, if you go on Funny or Die and type in Not Looking, it's, or YouTube, it's all there. But the first season's all like 4 minutes. And 4 minutes long each episode. I think we did 5. And afterwards, people were approaching us and they're like, when are you going to do season two? And we were like, oh, no, now we have to keep it going. And so that's when we, like, you know, did what every other artist does in L.A. We got a Kickstarter, and we raised the money, and we started shooting that in March of this year, and then I guess it came out in October, I think. No. September, something like that. September, October is when they all came out. And we actually got a lot of film festivals around the country that were interested and wanted us to screen, you know, the first episode of season two. So we, like, went to Sacramento. The Outfest in Los Angeles did it. I guess it, like, some Canada festival, film festival wanted it. And, I mean, it just kind of went everywhere. It was just kind of strange and fun. And we obviously had the budget, so each episode was, like, about 11 minutes. I think we did 5 episodes of 11 minutes. So we just had a lot more content, a lot more fun, a lot more jokes. We actually had Danny Francesi from the actual show Looking, who made a cameo. Lance Bass is in it. You know, Lance wanted to come back and be a part of it. And it was just a fun time, and it was just a lot of hard work. I know Jason almost was, like, homeless at one point because it was just
so much work. Yeah.
It's so much, yeah, you know, and we all have such busy schedules that it was like, we need to get together and work on stuff, and it's like, we could never all get in the same place at the same time, because, you know, Drew's always doing something, and I was always working, and Jason, it was nuts, but I'm glad it went well, and I'm glad it got such a good experience, and I'm glad people are actually watching it, so it was fun.
So much fun. Folks can check that out online. You know, they can also check out something that I watched earlier today. I was very entertained by Popping Off with Justin and Emerson.
Oh, yay! We're actually shooting that one again today, too, because they're going out of town tomorrow, Blake and Emerson are leaving. So, yeah, we've just been playing with that. Do you like it, though?
Tell everybody about Popping Off, and then I will give my impression. But, yes, I did like it.
Okay, good. So, Popping Off, Emerson Collins, you might know him from Bravo's The People's Couch. He's on there with Blake MacGyver and Scott Nevins. But Emerson and I have been best friends for, like, 15 years. We're both from Texas. We went to school together. He moved out here in L.A. around the same time I did. And he's just always been my voice of reason. I mean, he'll tell me, like, he'll check me in a heartbeat. And I'm like, oh, okay, you win this round. But, you know, he's obviously, he's worked on a whole bunch of different projects. He's on The People's Couch now. So he kind of has, like, this Bravo celebrity kind of vibe now. So he and I always had coffee dates. Like, we'd always have, like, one or two days of the week where we'd walk down Santa Monica Boulevard. We'd go to Starbucks, and we'd just walk down Santa Monica Boulevard with our coffee, and we'd just talk about what's going on, you know, catching up with one another, what's going on in pop culture, all that kind of stuff. You know, everyone's always like, Justin, when are you going to get on TV? So I'm like, well, when he figures it out. And so, I mean, I was going in for, like, all these auditions with E! And Bravo and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, God, just hurry up. So finally, like, Emerson and I were like, why don't we just do it? Like, Periscope had happened, and then now the Facebook Live stream is available. So Emerson and I, like, 2 weeks ago, were like, let's just do this, like, a weekly Friday. Take all the week topics or the weekly topics, and we'll just put our spin on it, like what we do when we go get coffee. And so it's just actually just been kind of fun. And we recount all the pop culture events of the week, and we just talk about them, and we're blunt, and we are, that's just us. How we are together, that's just how we are.
Let me just talk for a second about my own delusional world that I live in. There were a couple points where I was talking back to you both. That's how bad it got. It was very accessible. Very accessible.
Uh-huh. No, I love that. I love that. Yeah, it's very strange because I'm still getting used to it, where it's like, you'll have people who comment, and we try to, like, to talk back to the people. I don't think you can see it on Facebook, but you can see it on the actual phone app, which is kind of strange.
Right.
And so, like, you'll get these people who are, like, commenting and whatever, and so you'll, like, answer back and whatnot. And then afterwards, when the video gets posted, you'll have, like, 400 and something to, you know, 500-600 comments, and you're like, what the hell is all this? And you're like, oh, those are the people responding to it. So I'm still, like, trying not to be a grandpa and be like, what's all this technology about? You know?
I will just say I'm not a huge fan of when I'm watching some of these and it's so much starting and stopping because you're watching the people on the screen reading the comments and then responding. So
right.
I think you're better off not reading them as you go.
Yeah, I know. I do love a good troll, though.
They are enjoyable.
I love that. I just think it's so amazing, and Emerson's so good about it. And I get so angry and bitter, but he'll just be like, okay, cool, and like just brush them off. And then I'm just like, meet me in the parking lot. I'm outside of Trader Joe's. I'll show you what a fag looks like. Get over here. You know.
I love that you are just hanging out by bike racks in San Antonio, just fighting people. It's great.
I know. Yeah, that's me. It's like, you take the boy out of Texas. I'm just like, he say it to my face, boy. Yeah.
What do you have coming up that you are excited about?
What do I have coming up that I'm excited about? I will be in Savannah, Georgia next month with Julie Goldman.
Love.
From the People's Couch.
Yes.
We're performing together. I have to find the actual date and venue. I know we're going there. I just have to figure out where because it might have changed. I think it's a gay bar. I can't remember the name of it. I'm so awful about it. But I will definitely post it up on Twitter and Facebook for sure. And then I might be going to Hawaii next month.
Okay.
Yeah. Scarlet Bar Honolulu. They want, they're going to start a little comedy night. And then January, I may be in Denver at Comedy Works with Heather McDonald. And actually, if you want to listen to a fun podcast, check out hers. It's called Juicy Scoop. And actually, we have this whole conversation of, she was like, we need a juicy story. And I was like, well, should we tell them the story? It's a story of why I got blacklisted from Chelsea Lately. So if you want to hear that story, you can check that out on my Facebook because I put the link on there. So that is a fun story to listen to.
So
why
fun.
I was never on Chelsea Lately and will never be on Chelsea Lately.
Okay, so. But let's just keep in mind, did Chelsea Lately sing a duet with Patti LuPone? No, you did.
No, and she never will.
So there you go. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I have been following you around, Not Looking was such a favorite of mine. That was such a fun romp to check out. And people can check out clips of you online. Everyone can stroll on over to justinmartindale.com. And there's a ton of clips there. There are links there. Social media. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook and all of those fun social media. Justin, you entertain me, man.
Oh, well, thank you, Karen. I had so much fun.
Keep doing what you're doing.
I will. And I got some good stuff coming up. I just can't talk about it right now, but I'm hoping it kind of goes in the way that I want, so you'll be seeing a lot more of me.
Awesome. Everybody, justinmartindale.com. Thank you so much, Justin.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast.
I am the entertainer, and I know just where I stand. Another serenader and another long-haired band. Today I am your champion. I may have won your hearts, but I know the game, you forget my name, and I won't be here in another year if I don't stay on the charts. Ooh. I am the entertainer, and I've had to pay my price. Things I did not know at first, I learned by doing twice. Ah, but still they come to haunt me, still they want their say, so I've learned to dance with a hand in my pants. And I rub my neck and I write them a check and they go their merry way. Ooh. I am the entertainer, been all around the world. I played all kinds of palaces and laid all kinds of girls. I can't remember faces, I don't remember names. Oh, but what the hell, you know it's just as well, cause after a while and a thousand miles, it all becomes the same.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBT news out there. I was in Arkansas last week, and it's so ridiculous to categorize an entire state based on, you know, your preconceived notions of how LGBT-friendly that state might be, and I feel like I did that a little bit with Arkansas. And then these really great stories pop up that convince you, okay, maybe it would be okay to be gay and in Arkansas, and since I'm gay, gay. I don't know. Maybe I could be in Arkansas. This happened this week. An Arkansas judge ruled this week in favor of same-sex couples seeking to have both of their names listed on their children's birth certificates. Pulaski County Circuit Judge Tim Fox made his ruling from the bench in a case brought by three lesbian couples. Right this second, it only applies to these three lesbian couples, but Pulaski County Circuit Judge Tim Fox said he is considering broadening this case to apply to all same-sex couples in the state of Arkansas who have children. He's going to be issuing a written decision a little bit later. Cheryl Maples, the attorney for the plaintiffs, was optimistic that he would broaden the ruling. She said this, quote, "He made it pretty clear where he's going. It's another step forward for gay couples, and I'm sure the next step is right around the corner." This is very exciting news in Arkansas. There are so many barriers out there to supporting same-sex parents. And so this is just one of the many, and hopefully this will be broadened so that one more barrier has been eliminated and we can have both parents' names on the birth certificate. So that's good news out of Arkansas. Now, out of Minneapolis, this is not an LGBT story necessarily, but we have to start talking about intersectionality more and more and more, and not just solely focus on LGBT issues, but look at the intersection between sexual orientation and race, and do whatever we can do to support the struggles of racial minorities who are really trying to get their voices out there and being suppressed at all numbers of opportunities. So this past week, simmering racial tensions boiled over yet again this week when several men shot five people who had been protesting the recent police killing of an African-American man in Minneapolis. Police said that they had arrested two suspects. They are seeking others. On Monday night, five people suffered non-life-threatening gunshot injuries when at least one person opened fire on a crowd outside the Minneapolis Police Department's 4th Precinct building. Afterward, police said they were searching for three white male suspects who fled the scene. By Tuesday afternoon, police said they had arrested a 32-year-old Hispanic man in South Minneapolis and a 23-year-old white man in nearby Bloomington. The suspects were not identified and no other details were released. Now, I, over the past 7 years of doing news every single week on this show for 331 episodes, I think it's only been a handful of times that I've covered stories that didn't have something explicitly to do with LGBT-related issues. And this is one of those times, and I think it's just becoming more and more clear to me that, let me just speak from the eye, because that's always a good technique, I don't know that I'm doing enough to support racial justice and to support social justice and to change the rhetoric that's out there. Now, I'm a college professor who teaches all about race, but this is a platform that I have as well. This show is so gay as a platform, and the dearth of guests of color on This Show Is So Gay over the past 7+ years is really striking. And that's just me saying this on the air so that there can be accountability right this very second, that I need to do a way better job at representing issues of social justice, at representing issues of specifically racial justice on This Show Is So Gay, not just in the work that I do in the classroom, but at this intersectional point of sexual orientation and race. So that's why I wanted to do a shout out on this story, because we all need to do a better job. We just do. We do. So, in China, we're going to go across the seas for our next story. A court heard opening arguments this week in a case calling for textbooks published by China's Ministry of Education to alter or remove sections calling homosexuality a disease that can be cured. A student who goes by the pseudonym Qiu Bai discovered the issue 2 years ago when, as a curious freshman, she looked through medical textbooks seeking answers about her own sexual orientation. The 20-year-old showed NBC News one of the textbooks, and the textbook is called University Students' Mental Health, which states that gay people can change their sexual orientation through therapy. The student said this, quote, "I thought textbooks should be trustworthy, but when I saw these lines, I felt horrible. I was so worried about other people being afraid of gay people like me. This is discrimination against homosexuality." The Chinese Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from its list of mental disorders in 2001, but a 2014 survey conducted by China's Tongcheng Gay and Lesbian Campus Association found that 40% of textbooks published in the country after 2001 still classified homosexuality as a psychological disorder. So again, even though the Chinese Psychiatric Association since 2001, removed homosexuality from its list of mental disorders. 40% of textbooks published in the country still classify homosexuality as a psychological disorder. The student earlier this year wrote an open letter to the Ministry of Education pointing out the errors and requesting corrections. When she got no response, she filed the lawsuit in August. The number one municipal intermediate people's court in Beijing heard the case on Tuesday and decided to hold a second hearing. The student said this, quote, "I want related departments to admit these errors, and I want to have an equal and open discussion with them about these errors. This case is not even close to ending. Unless the Ministry of Education takes some real actions to change this, I won't give it up." And that is an end quote there. An unbelievable story out of China. And I've read all of these op-eds that are heralding this as a huge change in China. So yes, in 2001, that was a big deal that they removed, officially removed homosexuality from their list of mental disorders. But clearly the change has not permeated all sectors of Chinese society. And so that someone is actually suing, that's a big deal in China. I've been reading all about it. I encourage you all to read the same. Back here in the United States, Twitter, oh man, love this story. Twitter is putting the brakes on office blood drives until gay and bisexual employees can give too. Twitter spokesperson Natalie Miyake told CBS News, quote, "Twitter will not hold on-site blood drives in any office where local blood donation policies discriminate against broad categories of employees rather than on behavioral risk factors." Huge deal. This is a huge deal. The San Francisco-based company has 4,300 employees around the world, including more than 35 offices, 12 of which are U.S.-based. The FDA's blood donation policy, just to remind you all, I get nervous people don't know this. I think a lot of our listeners know this, but maybe we have some new listeners who don't know this. The FDA's blood donation policy currently bans gay and bisexual men from donating blood, even though medical leaders have argued for years and years and years that this ban is not scientifically warranted and that there are more effective ways to protect the blood supply. The Obama administration has recommended ending the lifetime ban, and earlier this year, the FDA proposed altering the policy to allow gay men to donate blood, but only if they have been celibate for the previous year. So first of all, there's this big misconception that's out there right now that the FDA changed their policy and we've moved to this one-year deferral if you've promised that you've been celibate for a year. No. We are still in the age of a lifetime ban on gay men giving blood. That's where we are right now. Gay men, bisexual men, women who have had sex with men who had sex with men since 1977. So yes, this was something that the FDA proposed, and we'll talk about why that's problematic in a second. But make no mistake about it. Right this second, while you are hearing the show, unless something miraculous happens in the next 48 hours before we post this episode, we are still under a lifetime ban. Gay men, bisexual men, and women who have had sex with men who have had sex with men since 1977, a lifetime ban from giving blood, even if you are someone like me who has that type of blood that will save all of you all, but I can't donate it because they won't take it. So first, let's just be clear, lifetime ban right now. Now, the one-year deferral, I'd be curious to see what Twitter thinks about that. I think it is so problematic. I just think it's so unrealistic, and I hate any policy that might cause people to lie. I'm not a fan of lying. That's not a thing that I endorse. And so the idea that this weekend I'm going to maybe have an unexpected sexual encounter with my boyfriend, you know, unexpected as in I'm not planning it right this second, right? Like we don't have these things scheduled, perhaps too much information for you, but just saying we don't have it scheduled. But the idea that I will say to him, I'm so sorry, Richard, but I can't have sex with you because I want to donate blood in a year. And by the way, I can't have sex with you for the next year. That is unrealistic, and it's just terrible. It's just terrible. So back to Twitter for a second. Twitter's Vice President of Global Policy, Colin Crowell, wrote to express, quote, deep concerns that both the current and proposed regulations restricting blood donations by men who have sex with men unreasonably removes viable donors from the process and discourages ethical companies from supporting and participating in blood drives. Crowell went on and told the FDA that, quote, issuing regulations that are discriminatory in nature and not based on actual risk factors create a conflict for companies companies with non-discrimination policies who want to participate in blood drives. I'm actually bouncing a little bit up and down as I read that because I've been saying that for so flipping long. Now, banning a blood drive, it is one of the most unenviable positions you ever want to be in. I don't want there to be less blood. I want there to be more blood. That's what I want. But what do you do if you work for an organization that has a non-discrimination statement that bars discrimination based on sexual orientation? If you have such a non-discrimination statement, most colleges and universities do, many, many companies do, a lot of states have that, then how do you invite the blood drive onto campus, which inherently discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation? How do you do that? How do you reconcile those two things? The way that we usually reconcile them is, well, it's, of course, it's a blood drive. Who wants to argue against a blood drive? It saves lives. And I certainly would never argue against the fact that blood drives save lives. They do. There is so much blood that is needed. The shortage is literally killing people. We need more blood. But if you are working at an organization, as I do, that protects for sexual orientation, I will just tell you, when I get those notices that say, hey, blood drive coming up, be a hero, it is so alienating for me. Because I have that blood. I want to be a hero. I always want to be a hero. I love comic books. Make me a hero. But I can't be a hero here because I am being told that I am dirty. That my blood is vile, that my blood will kill someone else, even though I just tested HIV negative. And by the way, we need to be able to share things like that. We need to be able to talk about our statuses. So yeah, just recently tested HIV negative. It covers my behavior. I will wait 3 months to cover that window, but then I should be able to donate blood. So there you go. For the past 2 years, Twitter employees have donated blood at a level 3 times the average for such drives, according to the letter that they sent to the FDA. But during another blood drive held in April, many employees expressed concern that Twitter was hosting an activity that, while critical for the public good, blatantly excludes some of the company's employees. So Crowell argued that the current regulations ignore a multitude of actual risk factors and will not make the blood supply any safer. They finally said this in a statement, quote, we are committed to making Twitter a place where everyone feels valued and will not sponsor on-site activities that discriminate against our employees. I'm so conflicted about this. Again, unenviable to argue against a blood drive. It feels like you're arguing against saving lives. But how do we pick and choose which parts of our non-discrimination statement to observe? It's a very slippery slope. And so there you go, Twitter. And I have no doubt that they are getting all kinds of flack for it. Unenviable position. When I've written posts about it for the Huffington Post, oh gosh, I get lambasted from all over the place and argued, you're just trying to kill people. I swear to you folks, I am not trying to kill anyone. I just don't know how we reconcile non-discrimination. I don't. Over in the world of education, a drama teacher's response to a homophobic parent's decision to withdraw her child from class last week has gone viral. Michael Neri is a theater producer in Birmingham, England, and he runs a drama school for kids called Talking Props. But recently, a parent decided to withdraw her child from Neri's school because she found out that he is gay. The mother wrote this in a text message, quote, you have a strong reputation for performing arts, which encouraged me to sign my children up for classes. I've recently learned of your lifestyle, and as a Christian, I cannot allow my children to be influenced by unconventional ideas. It is our belief that a man should marry a woman. A few hours after receiving that note last week, Neri wrote back a long response that he later shared on Twitter, where it has been retweeted thousands and thousands of times. In the response, he explained that he was fine with this mother's decision. He said, quote, I pride my students on the respect and love they have for others and their passion for equality. You would only be infringing on our family. So this is what he wrote. He said, hi to this parent. I would be lying if I said I was disappointed to hear this. I pride my students on the respect and love they have for others and their passion for equality. You would only be infringing upon our family. As far as I'm aware, my sexuality doesn't affect my ability to teach, just like it wouldn't affect a doctor's ability to treat one of your children should they become unwell. I'm sure your children's health would come first should they need emergency treatment, or would you need to check their doctor's lifestyle prior to their life-saving operation? I wish you luck in finding an appropriate stage school that meets your needs. However, from experience, I find that theater without gaze is like cooking without spices. This is just my opinion. I hear Stagecoach are enrolling, but their teachers have been known to wear mixed fabrics, which I'm sure you are aware of is forbidden in the Bible, Leviticus 19:19. Please feel free to come see our musical Happy Days. Confetti will be used in the finale, but please rest assured this is not an attempt to corrupt your Christian lifestyle. We just love glitter. Unfortunately, deposits are non-refundable, but don't worry, your deposit has been donated to Stonewall, an LGBT charity. Regards, Michael. Amazing. Amazing stuff there. Love it. Go check that out. Share it with others. Back here to the States, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention now believes one in four sexually active gay and bisexual men should take Truvada, the HIV prevention pill, also called PrEP. The conclusion, reached in a new report released this week, suggests potentially millions of people should take the pill daily. The report also found that one in five injection drug users and one in 200 sexually active heterosexual men should also take Truvada. Currently, only about 21,000 people, fewer than 1% who could benefit, take the drug, which is according to the CDC's Jonathan Merman. Truvada, again, also known as PrEP, is a daily pill, because we should be talking about this more, just so we're all on the same page. It's a daily pill that significantly curtails the risk of getting HIV from an HIV-positive partner. According to the CDC, daily PrEP reduces the risk of getting HIV from sex by more than 90%. One more time. According to the CDC, daily PrEP reduces the risk of getting HIV from sex by more than 90%, and the risk of HIV transmission from injecting drugs by more than 70%. It's even more effective if used in combination with condoms. But an alarming number of healthcare providers don't know about PrEP. A 2015 survey found that only 34% of primary care doctors and nurses have ever heard of Truvada. 34%. And this is a drug that can be 90% effective. The CDC outlines specific circumstances for which someone would have to take the pill. Generally, it's only deemed necessary if someone engages in risky behavior, which is defined as sex with an HIV-positive partner, sex with multiple partners, anal sex without a condom, and sharing needles to inject drugs. The CDC report comes at a somewhat dire time. Over the past few years, there have been signs that HIV, which about 1.2 million Americans have, is potentially on the rise among some younger populations. The data is now a bit dated, but in recent years, the CDC has found that HIV appears to be on the rise among young men who have sex with men. A 2014 CDC study found that among all groups, annual HIV diagnoses between 2001 and 2011 increased the most among 13 to 24-year-old boys and men who have sex with men. Previous CDC studies also found a 22% increase in the new annual HIV infections between 2008 and 2010 among the same group, and youth ages 13 to 24 accounted for more than 1 in 4 new HIV infections in the U.S. in 2010. So, I think a great place to start is with our healthcare providers. They have to know about PrEP. This, by the way, my friends, is not just for gay men to bring up to their healthcare providers. If you are listening to this and you see a healthcare provider, ask them, hey, do you know about Truvada? Do you know about PrEP? Because we want to start the road to everybody knowing about this, all the healthcare providers. It is not okay that only 34% of primary care doctors and nurses have ever heard of the drug. It's so difficult as it is for patients, not just gay patients, any patients, to go to their healthcare provider and talk about sexual activity. People have a hard enough time with that as it is, but to then talk to your doctors knowing they might not even know about Truvada, they might not know about this effective drug, and you have to educate your healthcare provider, well, it's not surprising that people are hesitant to do that. So, everybody, if you're listening to this, when you talk to your healthcare provider, say, hey, by the way, do you know about PrEP? Because that's, gosh, shouldn't we do like a mass mailing or something? That seems like something that we should be able to do a better job of. But certainly word of mouth, that will help. So talk to your healthcare providers about PrEP, whether you are gay, whether you are straight, no matter what category you are in, we need to spread the knowledge there. back to Pastor Kevin Swanson, who seems to have a place on This Show Is So Gay because he does something nutty every freaking week. He's taking a victory lap after his headline-making National Religious Liberties Conference in Iowa earlier this month. After hosting Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz, who, by the way, has rocketed to number 2 in the Iowa polls behind Donald Trump. So after hosting Republican presidential candidates Ted Cruz, Mike Huckabee, and Bobby Jindal, the Colorado preacher who calls for gays who don't repent to be sentenced to death, he went on the radio to reflect on the media firestorm he created. Generations radio listeners heard, that's a station, some sort of show, they heard Swanson declare that all the outrage over his remarks is proof that America is at war with God. He said this quote, "Anytime the nation has taken up a fight with the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the creator of the universe, you don't pick a fight with the creator of all of the galaxies, all of the planets, this entire solar system. You don't pull together a couple of ants and lift a fist to the Almighty and think you can get away with it. This is, I think, the reason why the media firestorm, we have touched the conscience of a nation, and they realize they're in trouble. They're in trouble with the God of the universe." So there you go. At his religious freedom conference, attended by about 1,700 people, I don't really care about the 1,700 people. That doesn't seem like that many, although, you know, 1,700 is not nothing. I care about the fact that Ted Cruz, who's currently in second place in some polls, was there. I care about the fact that Mike Huckabee, who I think is in the top 10, but he's not really up there. This guy gets presidential candidates. He's got some sway. So at this religious freedom conference, he announced, Pastor Swanson announced, that he believes that churches should have sackcloth and ashes at their entrances for Christian families whose sons are rebelling, hanging out with homosexuals and getting married, and their parents are invited. This is what he said. "And I would sit in cow manure and I would spread it all over my body," which I'm okay with him doing that. That's just bizarre anyway. But yeah, this is a guy who has effect. He does. He does have an effect. So we can't just dismiss people like this and say, oh, what a kook. What a kook this guy is. Because he's more than that. He really is. He's got some sway. Got some sway. Turning our attention over to the United States military, the U.S. Department of Defense wants male victims of sexual assault in the military to know that their voices are being heard, and the Pentagon is hoping to shed light on the alarming hurdles they face with an informative public service announcement. According to this video, this public service announcement put out there by the Department of Defense, out of the country's over 1.3 million active duty military personnel, 20,000 were sexually assaulted over the period from fall 2013 to summer 2014. The Department of Defense also reported that during the same time frame, between 9,000 and 13,000 active duty military men were sexually assaulted, and that although harassment and unwanted sexual advances declined for women between 2012 and 2014, there was reportedly no significant statistical change for men. Nathaniel Penn, in a GQ report on the growing epidemic of rape in the military, wrote this, quote, "The moment a man enlists in the United States Armed Forces, his chances of being sexually assaulted increase by a factor of 10. Women, of course, are much more likely to be victims of military sexual trauma, but far fewer of them enlist. In fact, more military men are assaulted than women, nearly 14,000 in 2012 alone. It is worth noting that the number of instances in which military men have been sexually assaulted could actually be quite higher, since, as the Department of Defense points out, the stigma many victims of assault face may prevent them from reporting what happened. Nathaniel Penn continued in this GQ piece by saying, quote, "An overpowering shame prevents many enlisted men from reporting an assault, a sense that they must somehow be complicit in what has happened to them. Straight men often question their own sexual orientation, while gay men may struggle to find intimacy in relationships because they don't trust other men or their own judgment. Telling the secret ruptures families and friendships, so does not telling." Gosh, this is really an issue that we need to be drawing attention to. So we need to do whatever we can do to support the men in the military who are experiencing sexual assault. What a terrible problem. What a terrible, terrible issue. There's a lot of attention being hoisted on the three out lawmakers who joined other Democrats in supporting a bill that was passed at the end of last week that suspends a program allowing Syrian and Iraqi refugees into the United States. The bill, which would still need Senate approval, comes following widespread security panic after the terrorist bombings and shootings in Paris. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said he will try to block the bill, according to CNN, but the majority in the House was large enough that it could override President Obama's promised veto if it gets to his desk. The bill passed 289 to 137, and 47 Democrats, including gay Congressman Jared Polis and Sean Maloney, plus bisexual Congresswoman Kristen Sinema, they joined 242 Republicans in favor of it. The LGBT vote in Congress was split, with three other out lawmakers opposing it, and those were David Cicilline, Mark Takano, and Mark Pocan. Jared Polis explained his support for the bill by saying he felt screening of refugees that is in place now needs improvement. He said, quote, "I think that we should pair a policy of increasing the number of refugees with more effective and better ways of vetting refugees." Very disappointing news, and certainly those three out congressmen are experiencing quite a bit of flack. Really disappointing. We will say this, though. In Oregon, out bisexual Governor Kate Brown joined several other governors in expressing her willingness to welcome refugees to her state. She wrote on Facebook this, quote, "The words of the Statue of Liberty apply in Oregon just as they do in every other state. Clearly, Oregon will continue to accept refugees. They bring their hopes and dreams to America, and we will continue to welcome them and open the doors of opportunity." And finally, one of Russia's leading newspapers published an article alleging that the U.S. government ordered controversial Russian LGBT activist Nikolai Alexeyev to start outing government officials, but it didn't take long for the U.S. Embassy in Moscow to debunk the error-riddled claim. When the U.S. Embassy in Moscow read this breathless report, staffers responded on Twitter, exposing the clearly fabricated nature of the letter by correcting the numerous grammatical and factual mistakes with a red pen. If you have not seen this, I encourage you to Google U.S. Embassy exposes fake pro-LGBT letter published Russian newspaper. It's really hilarious, but it's also extraordinarily effective. We like creative activism, and even our U.S. Embassy in Moscow, creative activism. Holy cow, that's a lot. That's a lot for this week's episode. That was a lot of news, a lot of charges for you to take action. And that's what we want you to do. We want you to use your voice in the way that you use it, whatever way is most effective for you to make a difference, to lift up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters, to start conversations with a healthcare provider about PrEP, to support our brothers and sisters of color who are struggling to get their voices out there and desperately need our support, be they gay or straight. This fight is one that we are all in together. Whatever it is that you do to raise up your voices, whether you are like Justin Martindale and you use comedy to bring people together, whether you can pen a column and write an article to your local newspaper, write a song, whatever it is that you do, start a conversation at Thanksgiving. Though be careful with that. We want it to be thankful and not a fight at Thanksgiving. But do whatever it is that you do to raise up the voices of those around you who desperately need it. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Summer nights are here to stay. We soul for a day, carry me, hold freedom to death.